Okay. All right, so we're going to get started. So the next talk is by Steve Smith. He'll be talking more first level, a little bit of second level topics, focusing more on temporal structure.
You guys
know
second level? Strictly first level?
Excellent. Great. I was told to do first level, so I'm first level.
Good. Hello. Thanks for inviting me, Tom Russ. I'm going to talk about basically exactly the same things that the previous talk covered. So if you slept through that, then now's the time to wake up, or vice versa. It is nice that I don't have to cover the GLM. Hopefully people already knew or now have a reasonable idea about GLM. Is there anyone who's not really happy about GLM and pseudo-inverses and stuff now? No hands. Oh, one hand. Grab me at lunch. I am going to cover many of the same issues, but I'm going to talk about a very different set of approaches which we've developed at FIMRIB in Oxford over the last 10 years. Mostly complementary kind of research to what we've just heard about. Most of what I'm going to talk about is time series analysis, which is what I was asked to talk about, but then towards the end I'm also going to talk about some of the spatiotemporal methods, because it's really impossible to answer some of the questions we're interested in without taking into account interactions across space, across voxels. Okay, so we've done GLM. One of the earliest pieces of work that we did at FIMRIB was early work by Mark Willrich on what happens when you have temporal autocorrelation or temporal smoothness in the data. We just heard a little bit about that. I'm just going to talk about an approach which we developed to model that. So what we see is that if you take just an unactivated voxels time series from fMRI data and you look at the power spectrum, so just do the FFT, it's not flat. It tends to have more power at low frequencies. And that's true even if you do, say, simple drift removal or simple high-pass filtering. It's still the case that you have more power at low frequencies. And this is partly due, like in signal, we've just seen a lot about the hemodynamic response function, the convolution kernel, which we think of as smoothing the neuronal firing. So the bold response is a smoothed and delayed version of the neuronal firing. But it's also various other primarily physiological processes which result in the data being temporally smooth. And the problem, the main problem which people worried about was that if you don't correct that, you get biostatistics, and that's because if the data is temporally smooth, you don't actually have as many independent time points as you thought you had. You thought you had 200 time points, but maybe you've only got, say, the equivalent of 150 independent time points. You call that degrees of freedom. And if you don't correct for that, you get biostatistics. And also, again, as we heard in the previous talk, you get decreased sensitivity. If somehow you can make this power spectrum flat, and that's what we were hearing about before, you can then get the best linear unbiased estimator, or the blue estimator, and get higher efficiency, which means you actually get lower error on the estimation of the activation. Mark Woolrich, working on this, took this a fairly standard approach of correcting for that. But what he had to do that was neat was get the estimates so that they were reliable. The problem is that estimating what we call the whitening kernel, I'll explain that in a minute, estimating that's a very noisy thing to do. In the typical number of time points that we have in real fMRI data, it's just not easy to get an accurate estimate. So what are we doing here? Well, familiar with the GLM, the data equals the model times the model parameters, which you're adjusting so that the model fits the data, and then the noise. Now we're going to estimate the noise just by estimating the fitted model and subtracting that from the data. And that, in general, gives us a reasonable estimate of the underlying noises. It's not exactly the same thing, but it's close enough. And then we're going to use that estimate of the noise to estimate what the temporal smoothness in the data is. So that's this first step. We get the residuals and we look at the power spectrum. But that power spectrum, as I said, is noisy. If we use that to try and whiten the data or remove the smoothness, we end up just putting more noise into the whole system, which is a pain. So we need to regularize it. And that just means smooth it in a number of ways. So we actually do two things. First, we smooth the data spatially. And what we actually do is we take the estimated power spectrum. We actually work. You can interchangeably work either in the power spectrum space or just you can think in terms of the raw autocorrelation coefficients. But it's simpler to think of it in terms of the power spectrum. We take that and then we just smooth that very locally with some of the neighbours, just the immediate neighbours, the neighbouring voxels, and we only smooth it with neighbouring voxels that are within the same tissue type. And we judge that by looking at the raw intensity, the mean intensity of the voxels. So if you're within the same tissue type, then you get smoothed. Because we know that the different tissue types will quite likely have very different temporal smoothness, different underlying power spectra. So we're going to smooth within tissue type, but we do want to stay fairly local, because one thing we know is that this temporal smoothness process varies a lot across the brain, so we certainly don't want to try and estimate this globally. The other regularization, or improving our estimate of the power spectrum here, is that we spectrally smooth it. So you can think of it just as a convolution or a smoothing of this function. And then you're left with this, and you can just do one over that, and you get the opposite, and you can now think of that as the whitening filter. So the data looks like this. You get a filter just by inverting it, which you apply to the data, and then hopefully the data has flat power spectrum. So it's just a bit of detail about how we try and do this whitening. And once you've applied that to the data, you also have to apply it to the model so that it still matches the data. And then we refit, we re-estimate the betas. And now the betas, the model parameters that we estimate, have more accuracy than they did the first time round, and that was the point. So examples here, if you've got a simple boxcar design, it makes almost no difference, so it's not too important. But as you go to single event designs, in particular dense, randomized event-related designs, then compared with much simpler approaches for correcting the bias caused by the temporal smoothness, you get up to a factor of 2 increase in your z-statistics. So that was the original work that we did on correcting for the temporal smoothness, and this is still what we regularly use as the default GLM approach in FSL. We've also done quite a lot of work on variations in the hemodynamic response function. I'll skip fairly quickly through this section because there's actually a lot of overlap with the nice work presented in the previous talk. So to summarise why we care about the hemodynamic response, there is a lot of variability in the shape of the hemodynamic response across subjects and across space. And somehow we don't want to assume that that's fixed, otherwise we can end up with inaccurate estimation, we can end up with inefficient estimation. So as was described, the simplest and probably still the most common approach is to add in the temporal derivative. So you have your covariate of interest, and if you differentiate that, or look at how that each point is changing from time to time, you get the temporal derivative. And if you add that in as a second regressor in your model, then this can, at the very least, soak up some of the error in the timing between the model and the data. And you can see that here. The main regressor in green has been shifted when you look at the full model fit to the left. And the reason this works is very trivial math. It's just a Taylor series expansion allowing that to improve the quality of the overall fit. So that's probably the least interesting but the most common approach. And more interesting is looking at more advanced models of the HRF. So here we've got a parameterization which actually looks very similar to the parameterization that we saw in the previous talk. It's different. It's a whole bunch of half cosines rather than the logit function. It's a very similar number of free parameters. But as was just described, this is to fit this properly is non-linear, and that's a relatively hard thing to do. I'll come back to that. So instead of that, an easier thing to do that you can apply within the GLM is to use basis sets. And again, these were previously covered. Now, what we've got here is, for example, three different, you can think of them as hemodynamic response function convolutions, and we're going to take some combination of those to fit what we actually see in the data. And this is very easy to do within the general linear model framework. You just take linear combinations, i.e. Multiply here the main HRF by 1, the second one by 0.3, blah, 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 and you get an HRF, or you can try a different combination, and you get a different HRF, and you can automatically adjust for that within the framework of the general linear model, because these effectively are the betas which are estimated, so it will be estimated for you. How do you choose optimal basis functions to stick in as your convolution functions in the model? Well, one of the nice things that Mark Woolrich did was go back to this full parameterization and start with that, and then work out from that what the optimal basis functions should be. And this is we call FLOBS, one of our sillier acronyms. So we have several parameters here that describe, say, the height of the undershoot, the recovery time, the time to peak, and these are all relative. The height parameter is relative to a baseline to peak height of 1, which is fixed, because we're going to estimate the actual activation height as a separate parameter to the basis functions. And then for each of these, we're going to specify a priori what a reasonable range of those parameters is. So, for example, the height of the undershoot, sometimes you just don't see it in the data, so you might allow that to go down to 0. Or you might allow it to be 0.3, so 30% of the peak height. So that's a reasonable range. So we specify a range for each of these, and then we take thousands of samples. For each sample, we randomly choose the parameter from the range allowed. We form the overall shape, and that is our sample HRF. We take thousands of those, and that's what we see here. And then we do very simple singular value decomposition, like PCA, decomposition on these samples, and we take the top eigenvectors which explain most of the variability. And so when we look at, say, the top three, it actually just almost always turns out, just comes out in the wash, that we tend to get that the first basis function, the first eigenvector, looks like the canonical HRF, the second looks like the temporal derivative, and the third looks like the second derivative, or the derivative that adjusts for the width in the HRF. But because we've derived these, and we can take more than three if we wish, because we've derived these from the priors that we put on the range of shapes that we might possibly expect to see in the data, we know that this is the optimal basis set for spanning the space of possible bold hemodynamic response functions. So we can then just feed these back into the GLM and use these with confidence that they actually cover the range of shapes that we expect to see. Or we can go further, and again this is analogous to what we saw in the previous talk, we can go further and do the proper hardcore Bayes. We can take all of the different parameters in the HRF, put them into one big joint model on all of the parameters. We can use MCMC to marginalize out all of the parameters in the HRF and get the height of the activation. So what do I mean there? Well, the full posterior has all of the parameters in it. So it's just one very big equation that you're trying to, if you like, fit to the data, including all of the HRF parameters and A, which is the activation height. So you've got the convolution kernel convolved with the neural activity times the activation height plus noise. That's the full model. One of the things you can do with Bayes, and in this case with Markov chain Monte Carlo, is to marginalize over the parameters you're not interested in. All that means is you're integrating them out, you're averaging over them to get rid of them, because probably you may not care about them. and you then get your best possible estimate of the activation height. So this is something that we've also been working on, as well as the simpler approach that fits into the GLM. And although this can, in certain circumstances, give more information, give better quality fitting, a lot of the time the GLM is good enough, which is why it is still by far the most commonly used approach. And again, as was hinted before, MCMC can be incredibly slow, so the GLM is very easy, very quick. Okay, the next piece of work is taking yet another approach to some of the important issues in the time series modelling. So far, everything I've talked about, although the fitting may have been nonlinear and the HRF parameterization may, in that sense, be nonlinear, the actual idea of the model being formed by a convolution of an HRF with the paradigm timing, the stimulus timing, has still been always linear. But what we're thinking about in more recent work, where we're looking at temporal deconvolution, is an attempt to get more sophisticated models of potentially nonlinear processes in the underlying neural activity. So this is taking everything that I've just described even further on in terms of richness of fitting to data. So what we're basing this work on is work from the PhIL in London, the SPM lab, where Will Penny has done some really nice work called Bilinear Dynamical Systems. And the idea here is that looking at the neural firing, the neural firing is not necessarily just an exact copy of the stimulus timing, whereas in everything that I've talked about earlier in the talk, it's assumed that they're basically the same thing. So in an approach like BDS, you also have other inputs, which we call the modulatory inputs, and these modulatory inputs can actually affect the way that the neuronal system responds to the stimulus timings. It's no longer a simple copy or a simple linear system. And it's very similar to the maths which Will Penny has also developed for DCM, dynamic causal modelling, except an obvious difference here is that this is an analysis of a single voxel's time series, whereas in DCM, the modulatory inputs might be time series from other points in a function network, so other voxels or regions of interest. In this case, the modulatory inputs, if you have any, would be specified, for example, as other things going on in the experiment. So your main input might be flashing checkerboard, your modulatory input might be, say, turning a drug on and off. So this is really nice work. What Salima Makhni at FIMRIB has done is start on that and add a few tweaks onto that, which seem to work really well. One is that rather than pre-specifying the HRF, which is what's going on in Will's work, we're estimating this in a very flexible way from the data. So now it's even more flexible than the basis functions that I was just talking about. It's actually allowed to be any shape you like, as long as it's temporally smooth. And so this will actually give you an estimate of the hemodynamic processes, not just for the simple activation, but possibly maybe informative about noise processes as well. But I'll come back to that at the end of the talk. The other thing which Salim has done, which is nice, is to do a full Bayes model on this bilinear dynamical systems network or time series modelling. So that's full Bayes using variational Bayes. So what do we have? You can think of these as just three things going on in the experiment, three external influences. So we've got the driving inputs, if you like, maybe just a flashing checkerboard that lasts just half a second each time, so event-related. Then we've got two separate modulatory inputs. Maybe you're listening to people talk in a block design. Maybe you've got some drug coming on and off. Just other things going on. But the crucial thing is that whereas the driving inputs or the simple stimulation appears in a very simple way in the model of what's going on neurally, the modulatory inputs are acting in a nonlinear way, because they appear here on the left, but they appear next to the previous time point status. So they're affecting how the history is developing, if you like, the nonlinear dynamics there. So then we just take the recent history of the neural model and convolve it with the HRF, which we're actually estimating, it's not fixed, and then we get the data. So we've got noise coming in at the level of the bold data. We've also got noise coming in neuronally, so two separate noise processes. So in a simple simulation here, we're seeing relatively poor fitting, certainly once you look at the HRF, from the previous expectation maximization approach. But with the full Bayes, we get very nice fitting. But then we would, because we simulated it from our own model. So how do we fit this? Well, to do the full Bayes, the two obvious approaches, you can either use Markov-chain Monte Carlo. It's basically a nice sophisticated way of taking millions of random samples of the parameters in the model and finding out how they work in terms of fitting the model. It's the gold standard approach, but it takes ages. You basically set this going and then go and raise a family. Or you can use variational Bayes, and you shift all the work from the computer to your brain, and you have to do some nasty integrals. It may actually not necessarily be appropriate for many models, but if the model is appropriate, in this case it is, for variational Bayes. So in this kind of approach, instead of doing everything just done computationally, you're actually trying to do some nasty integrals, because you're going to try and end up with an analytical approximation to the Bayes posterior distribution rather than just sample from it. So you have to do some nasty integrals, but if you can do them, then you get a much, much quicker approach. So for example, one of the things that we're estimating and that we had to do the integrals on was the variational free energy. It's a very simple equation, it's here. we'll get you to rederive that in the coffee break. And that's what we've done here. That's what Salim has spent some weeks working on, and it leaves you with a very quick and reasonably accurate estimate to the full Bayes. I'll come back to this work after the section on ICA. So everything I've talked about now has been what we often call model-based, although when we contrast what we call model-based and model-free for what I'm about to talk about, what we're really talking about is whether or not we are pre-specifying the experimental paradigm, so the experimental paradigm model. So I've talked about lots of different ways of doing model-based analysis. This is very complementary work which Christian Beckmann has been doing over the last 10 years. This is based on independent component analysis, and this is trying to find interesting things going on in the data without having to pre-specify the model, and there's a whole number of reasons why that's of interest. Because we're no longer putting in information about the experimental timing, we've got to somehow make up for that lack of knowledge, and so we move from analyzing every voxel's time series independently from every other voxel, which is often called univariate or massively univariate analysis, to looking at the entire data set, the entire four-dimensional data set, in one big simultaneous analysis. So that's often called multivariate. So it's a spatio-temporal model looking at space, i.e. voxels, and time. And because we're now looking at all of the voxels, we can, for example, find sets of voxels which are all acting in cohort with each other. If we can find sets which are all doing the same thing over time, then we can start to believe that that's an interesting process in the data. And it's basically by doing that kind of thing that all of the multivariate methods work. So how do we arrange the data? We arrange the data into two dimensions. So we've got time and we've got space. So space means we're just unwrapping all of the voxels along one line. So we've got like one row, the next row, the next row. We're just unwrapping all of the voxels. And then we've got time. So we've got a 2D data matrix. And then we're going to decompose that 2D data matrix into a set of spatial maps and time courses. So we're going to decompose this matrix into two matrices, which you could multiply together to get back to the original data. So we're going to have a whole series of time courses, times maps or components, and a whole series of spatial maps. And so what one nice way of thinking about this is that this kind of decomposition gives you a series of components, each of which is described by a single spatial map, for example, an activation pattern across space, and a single time course, for example, the activation time course. And mathematically, how you get back to the original data is to take the outer product of the time course and the spatial map and then add it to the same across all of the different maps. The difference between, a principal component analysis, which presumably many people here are more familiar with, and independent component analysis, is a difference in the underlying assumptions about the differences between the components. So whereas in PCA, we'd find all these different interesting components on the basis of explained variance and an assumption that all of the time courses have to be orthogonal, ICA relaxes that. And that's quite important and turns out to give a big improvement in ICA or PCA for fMRI data. An obvious example here is if you have activation in one time course, and then you have head motion being described as artifacts that you find in the data in other components. Now, it's quite common for head motion artifacts to be partially correlated with the design, because you often have correlation between head motion and the stimulus. And so to enforce those to be orthogonal or independent of each other means that you can't actually get a very good description of the data in a PCA decomposition. Now, in independent component analysis, that's actually relaxed. There are no rules about how the time courses have to relate to each other. So, for example, in this case, you can get a nice, accurate representation of whatever's in the head motion separately from the activation. So, to make up for that relaxation of the rules in the temporal domain, the rules are strengthened in the spatial domain, and so in the spatial maps, we now have the rule that the different spatial components have to be completely independent of each other. Not just orthogonal, they have to be completely statistically independent. Any one spatial map is not allowed to tell you anything about another one. And it turns out to be relatively easy to run that kind of analysis. One thing that's very important, I won't talk about in detail, is the issue of how many components to look for. And so one of the things that Christian spent a lot of time on was trying to get an objective estimate of how many components to try and find using the ICA in the data. If you take too few, then you'll end up mixing up various different data processes together into the same components. If you take too many, then you'll end up splitting what are conceptually, say, one component, say the activation, into lots of different components. And it becomes, in that case as well, difficult to interpret your data. So Christian's done some nice Bayes analysis on trying to get that balance between the two extremes right. And so one difference is that if you just run standard ICA, if you compare the GLM analysis of visual activation with standard ICA, you get this very hard to interpret splitting of the activation across several components. It's kind of hard to interpret, whereas when we run the probabilistic ICA, probabilistic means that we've put in this underlying noise model and done the Bayes to estimate the number of components, you get what vision scientists find a very explicable and robustly reliable, repeatable result, which is that we get the main activation, and then we also get a secondary component with a slightly different time course that probably corresponds to the motion visual areas. So run through very quickly a few example applications just to give a bit of a flavour of things that you can do with this kind of approach. You can investigate the bold response. So in this case, with the standard HRF model in the GLM, we've got this activation. We've got very similar activation from the ICA. We've got a few more interpretable areas, as well. But we've, you can see, we've done a very similar job to the GLM of estimating the HRF, the brain responses over time. But we will have gotten a more accurate estimate because it is estimated from the data. Probably the most common use of ICAs so far is to at least understand, if not eliminate, artifacts in the data, and it's very good at finding any structured process in the data. So it will automatically estimate slice dropouts, and here you can actually see three different components, each with their own associated time course. So this is when the scanner is malfunctioning. Again, scanner malfunction, gradient instability, EPI ghosting, high-frequency noise, probably vascular, I guess. Residual head motion, which you often have, you almost always have residual head motion even after correction in the pre-processing. Field inhomogeneities, eyeballs. So now the next couple of slides are talking in more detail about why we care about structured noise. So the kinds of artifacts I just showed you are examples of structured noise. This is noise which mathematically we say is not just pure, simple Gaussian noise. Why do we care? Well, if we leave the structured noise in, then obviously it will inflate the residuals in the model base. So if we could get rid of them, we'd have lower residuals, we'd have more significance in their activation. But because there's possibly some temporal correlation between the structured noise processes, for example the head motion, and the model, the noise may not just appear in the model errors, but it may also work its way into our parameter estimates, the betas. And so that would give it, that could give us increased false positives or false negatives, depending on the sign of the correlation. In either case, it would be nice to remove that. And it turns out ICA is really good at removing that. You can, for example, a very simple approach is to run ICA on your data, identify, if you like, just by hand, the obvious strong structured noise, and you can just subtract that out of the data and then run your GLM. This is an example of what you get if you look at a simple GLM Z-statistic histogram. So if you have an activation Z-statistic, it's supposed to look like basically a pure Gaussian, zero-centered, unit standard deviation, and then possibly with a tail where the activation boxes show up. But it should be a nice, clean Gaussian, but because of the structured noise, it often isn't. And so you just have very inaccurate, messy inference, particularly at first level. And so with the kind of simple ICA denoising I was talking about, this is what the Z-stat looked like before. This is after cleaning, obviously greatly improved. This is just another session. Again, it's a real mess before doing the structured noise removal, and much nicer afterwards. And this is the corresponding images. We've got nice clean activation afterwards, nothing before the cleanup. And you can also see from, say, David McGonigal's repeatability experiments, where he did the same task 33 times. You look at this, there's quite a lot of apparent variability across the sessions. After ICA cleanup, we get more activation, we also see a lot more consistency across the sessions. And finally, I won't talk in any detail about this, but ICA is also really good for finding structured patterns in resting fMRI, which are often termed resting state networks. So it's really good that this is an area which is very rapidly taking off in brain mapping. People don't exactly know what these things are. They're probably some kind of functional networks, and they turn out to be really interesting, looking at resting state networks in the brain. And ICA is good for not just finding them, but separating them from each other. So we've got these well-characterized resting networks that we see in both, not just resting, but actually activation experiments as well. Here's another set. And they turn out to be probably really useful, for example, for clinical markers. And because these different networks in a resting data set have different temporal dynamics, an approach like ICA is very good at separating them from each other and from the other artifacts. Okay, so coming back to Salimi's work on the temporal deconvolution, the BDS modeling. You can also apply exactly the same approach to ICA time courses to help interpret the ICA time courses. So this is likely to work even better than applying it to a single voxels time series, because in general a temporal component from an ICA analysis will be much cleaner, less noisy than a single voxels time series. So you can feed the same thing in and get inference on what's going on for that component. So by taking, for example, an activation component from an ICA decomposition, feeding that into this approach, you can estimate the underlying neuronal responses and the HRF. And because this is a full Bayesian analysis, we can get not just the mean of these things, but the full spread about them just by looking at the posterior distribution from the Bayes estimation. We can also, if you like, divide the mean by the uncertainty and get a probability of the neuronal response over time. So the final section then is trying to basically bring the best of everything that I've talked about, the work that we've done over the last 10 years, into one big integrated, nice approach. So to recap on GLM, we have the data, we have a very specific prediction, and we fit the model parameters. This is good because it allows us to draw very clear and simple conclusions about a particular question or questions. If we have different processes in the experiment, different conditions which we want to test whether one condition is more effective than another condition at activating the brain, it's very easy with the GLM approach to do that. However, the results obviously depend on the model, so if the model's wrong, your results are daft. It's also not a good approach for taking into account all of the other things going on in your data, the structured noise, for example. It's not good at finding and eliminating that. By contrast, the ICA is very, very complementary. It's data-driven multivariate. It doesn't need to know anything about the fMRI paradigm. And it's very good at, for example, finding structured noise or finding where the activation time course is a bit different from what you expected. But in some ways, it's much harder to answer questions that you'd like to ask about the data with this kind of approach. So because you didn't actually put the model in, you can't ask about whether one process in the experiment, one condition, activated more that one part of the brain more than another condition. You don't know if one rate of the flashing checkerboard activated the visual cortex more than another rate of flashing checkerboard, because you can't directly ask those questions. For example, if you have two very similar conditions, like different rates of flashing checkerboard, the ICA won't necessarily give you one component separated out for each of those conditions. It might give you one component that's kind of the average response to both, and then the other might be the difference between them if you're lucky, but you can't pre-specify what we call contrasts or questions of the data. So how do we try and get the best of both worlds? We are just going to put the GLM inside the ICA. So we're going to force some of the ICA temporal components to look like the model. And in this way, we can immediately get all the benefits of the GLM, because we know which of the temporal components correspond to regressors in the model. We can ask contrasts between different conditions in the experiment. But we've got all the richness of fitting all of the other structured processes in the data. Because these time courses between the predicted response and all of the other estimated artifacts, they don't have to be orthogonal or independent. They don't have to be independent of each other. So we're still able to get a really nice estimate of the head motion, even if it's partially correlated with the model. So hopefully we get the best of both worlds. And so the final tweak on that is to apply Salima's work to the modeling. So the HRF deconvolution So we can still, within the model, model time series part of this ICA decomposition, we can still estimate the HRF from the data and get very flexible but powerful modelling on that. And here's one of the first examples. This is still early work, but we've got some real examples already. So from one data set, applying this approach to the data set, we've automatically found the auditory activation in the visual by putting in the stimulus timings for those conditions. We've estimated the HRFs for those from the data, and we found a whole bunch of structured noise. And so we're very hopeful that as this work matures, we would be able to recommend this as the default method, and it really would bring the best of everything that we've done so far together. Thank you.
Great, thanks, Steve. Any questions?
Could you give an intuition for what is different between the full specification approach that you just presented at the end, and instead just doing the ICA to identify structural noise, taking that out of the data and just running the GLM on the resulting data? What is different between those two things?
Yeah. So the question is a very good one. What's the difference between the integrated GLM and ICA approach, which I've just presented, and the simpler approach of just cleaning up the data with the ICA and then rerunning the GLM? There's certainly a lot of mathematical similarity between the approaches. One obvious difference is that when you do the cleanup, you have to identify by hand which components you want to clean up. And that can be quite hard, because you can get some that are kind of, it's really hard to know what they are anyway. They might be, some of them that are hardest to interpret might be artifact, they might be activation, you just don't know. Whereas in the integrated approach, that's not a concern. It's all handled for you. That's one obvious thing. And another issue is that where you have orthogonality or non-orthogonality between the artifacts and the regressors of interest, depending on whether you want to force all the variance into the artifact or into the activation, again, that's an option for you with this approach, with the integrated approach.
So you have a question back there somewhere, and then see? Yeah.
So how, I don't know if you've done the experiment for this particular situation, but how different would the results be if you ran ICA first, got rid of coherence whose time series didn't go through the stimulus automation, and then picked up on the rest?
I thought that was the previous question.
How different would it be?
With respect to the previous question, how much difference will it make? It will depend on the data. So it will depend on, for example, how much and what kind of structured noise you have in the data. It will depend on how successful the user is at identifying by eye. So far, people have not been very successful in developing methods for automatically identifying or classifying ICA components. So it'll depend on those things. but the final approach, which I presented, which uses the bilinear dynamical systems, obviously still also has the big advantage of things like estimating the HRF from the data, which standard ICA cleanup plus GLM would not have. Well, we're not generally thinking in terms of training sets, and the kind of work that Steve Struther, I guess, is going to describe in more detail. We're more thinking in terms of the best possible fitting of the best possible model to the data. So, at the risk of sounding evangelical about Bayes, if your model is reasonable and you do Bayes, then your posterior information about all the parameters is all you really need to know. And it's true.
Okay,
like all estimation techniques, if it's reasonably good, you get a reasonably good result.
Now, my question is, we've been having some trouble with ICA, particularly in simulations, particularly, and my impression is you actually need reasonably dirty data for it to work well. If your data actually gets relatively close to multivariate Gaussian, then the dimensionality estimate doesn't seem to work very well, and it tends to split what are coherent covariance networks across multiple components.
Yeah, so the question is, in Steve's simulations, I guess this is Canadian noise, it's you're seeing ICA not perform so well in the simulations, and Steve's hypothesis is that you need a lot of noise for it to work. I think I wouldn't agree with that. I'd say something slightly different, which is that various parameters in the melodic software are set up assuming fMRI data. They're tuned for real fMRI data, which doesn't mean that the method is requires a lot of noise, but it's tuned for the kind of noise we typically see in real data. So that's
what I mean is you need dirty noise. You actually need things like head motion that maybe is coupled repeating artifacts on the image.
I think
so. If you have a very clean fMRI data set, and the physicists are getting better and better at producing those for us, trying to push, for example, motion correction into the acquisition phase. I mean, I just think it's something we need to be careful about as we bring these models in that require certain types of relationships between the structured noise and the actual signal.
So the question is not so much the size of the noise, but whether or not you have lots of different structured noise components. So the same answer really goes for this question of dimensionality estimation, and Steve is saying that if there's not enough structured noise, then in practice our approach, say, for estimating the number of components doesn't do so well. Again, so the first part of the answer to that is, again, our approach to dimensionality estimation has been tuned under the assumption of real fMRI data, and under real fMRI data it seems to do a good job of that. More satisfying answer is that this final approach, the Bayesian approach, one thing I didn't say, is that as part of the estimation of every component, we're putting what's called in Bayes automatic relevance determination prior on every component. What this means is that we can actually, with the new method, start by overestimating, if you like, the number of components, but then use the ARD prior to automatically turn off those for which there's not enough evidence in the data. And so that should give us a much more powerful way of accurately finding the number of components than, say, we're using right now.
Did you?
Yeah, perhaps I'm not totally understanding the combined analysis, but when we try and estimate the Z statistics for each of the modeled time courses in there, what are you actually using in the variance? How are you incorporating the fits to these ICs? Or are you just looking at the proportionality in that data and the residuals after the ICs?
Right, so Mark's question is, how do we take the results that we're seeing here, for example, these spatial maps, and make them look like what we're used to from standard GLM, which is we're used to thinking of these, for example, as Z-statistics, where we've basically normalized the activation height by the residual errors. Where do these different things come from in that kind of analysis? One thing is that part of the dimensionality estimation is estimating the amount of background Gaussian noise in the data, and that effectively if you have 200 time points and you reckon there's 300 components, then effectively the other 170 components in the initial decomposition before the full ICA are treated as Gaussian noise. And so traditionally what we do in the original ICA work, which is not what we're looking at here, in melodic, you would use that estimate of the Gaussian noise when you do inference on each individual spatial map. So that's where you get the noise estimate from. Although, having said that, when you actually look at the final spatial maps, the most common way of doing inference is to run a mixture model. But I won't go into that. That would take us off track. When it comes to Salima's integrated approach, it depends exactly what you want to do. If you want to do, if you want to look at how the voxels are differently significant from each other, then you could potentially use, say, a mixture model, and that allows you to do null hypothesis testing or alternate hypothesis testing, anything you like, but it certainly includes throwing away the alternate part of the mixture model and just doing null hypothesis testing, i.e. treat this as a pure Z-map. But more interestingly, because we're doing all the temporal modeling on the time series with this variational Bayes full Bayesian approach to the neuronal firing, we can also do inference on the significance of the actual neuronal firing separately from understanding the spatial map.
Okay, one final question, maybe from someone other than Steve. Back here, Ed?
I was wondering, for my own understanding, if you compare like the cleanup of the noise here to what you do if you just do conventional analysis, where you have predictors for motion and in a model, how does it, what part of the noise is going to be, could be something, kind of explained by that, and what part is
again, like the other question, it depends very much on how dirty your data is. And, for example, things like how correlated the head motion is with the actual activation. One of the unfortunate things about confound-based regressors in the GLM, for example, if you take the head motion parameters and put them in the GLM, is that the conservative thing to do is to assume that all of the variance that's shared between those and the activation should go with the confounds. But in such an ICA approach, that's not necessary because it will automatically separate the different things out.
Okay, maybe one last question here.
So how independent are the components that match to those regressors that you're forcing in the matrix?
How independent are the spatial maps?
The spatial maps.
From each other. This is still fully within the ICA framework, so spatially all the components will have to be exactly independent from each other, which turns out to be a weaker constraint than you might think for various practical issues.
So, along the same line, so usually in ICA, the input is the data matrix and the output is the time course and so how are you focusing, so which spatial map do you correspond to the GLM time course? How do you enforce that?
Right, so the question is, we've now got two constraints in the ICM. We've got the spatial independence and the fact that we're forcing some of the time series to be certain time series. So there's various ways that we're looking at. We're not decided on exactly what we'll do, but one very simple heuristic way of starting is simply to force the first few components to follow these time courses, and then after that we then run the generic ICA on the rest of the components. Now obviously that's potentially in conflict with the previous answer, which is that they have to be exactly spatially independent. So we've got to get a balance between those some way.
And then you also have the problem of commutation of components. You can't fix the components. ICA has a problem of commutation. The components could be different orders in different orders.
Right, so the question is about the ordering of the components.
Right.
Well, questions of ordering are very dependent on the particular ICA algorithm that you're using. The one that we tend to use mostly by preference does actually pull out one component at a time rather than all components simultaneously, so it's very easy to adapt that to do this approach.
So which
algorithm? Our approach is based on fast ICA.
Alright, let's stop there and take another 5-minute break, and let's thank Steve again.